Blog Talk Radio.
Hey guys, welcome again to another episode of Everyone Hates Ryan. The voice you're hearing is your friend and neighbor Ryan. Ryan, follow me on Twitter at rhancock19. And today we're joined by Times Ticket News Sunday editor James Cart, and you can follow him on Twitter at James Cart. And what we'll be discussing for the next half hour is favorite is our urban legend regarding the city of New Orleans. That being said, James, welcome to the podcast. How are you doing this morning?
I'm good. I'm doing great.
Well, that's glad to hear now. Granted, folks, this is something different from what we normally do. Fridays at 6:30, the Porter Street Social and Football Club. Presented to you by your friends and neighbors at Magazine Pizza, 1068 Magazine Street. Magazine, Lower Garden District, New Orleans. So this is a half hour devoted to things that that I would like to learn about, things that people, that our listeners would like to learn about, concerning the city of New Orleans or even here in Memphis where I am now. So jumping right into it, we're going to be discussing some urban legends. And James, my favorite one would be, it's basically the one about the Superdome, because for so many years, I didn't see the Superdome for the first time until 2013. And for the longest, I always was told it was always built on a cemetery. Yeah. For years, when I went down to help with the relief after Katrina, they always told me that the Superdome was built on top of a cemetery. Is that really true, because it wasn't until recently I learned what it was actually really built on.
Right. As I understand it, I should tell you, I'm not an expert on the Superdome. I know a lot about how the construction proceeded. I know that it was way behind schedule and way over budget. You know, they were supposed to have, I think it was Super Bowl IX was supposed to be at the Superdome, and they ended up having it at Tulane Stadium. It was the last one at Tulane Stadium because the dome wasn't ready in time. But my understanding is, yeah, that it's not built on the cemetery. It's built, you know, close to a cemetery, but not on top of it. So that sort of dispels the theory that the Saints are somehow cursed, which, of course, the Saints won the Super Bowl, Super Bowl XLIV anyway. So, yeah. Not built on a cemetery.
Okay. All right. Well, that's one thing. Another thing that I would like to discuss, and this is some stuff that I've been talking to you and I think Richard Campanella about some stuff about New Orleans history, mainly like just some of the cityscapes. Every time
you
I
read
go
the
to
great
New Orleans,
column.
I have a very Yes, I know. I've read some of his columns. One of the things that I've always had trouble with is figuring out which way is north, which way is south, which way is east, which way is west. Now, I know when they say the east, New Orleans east, they mean, you know, they're talking about I-10, you know, I-10 going east. But
right.
When it comes to, like, if you're in, like, the Lower Garden District, or in Uptown, there's like you see North Carrollton, South Carrollton, North Claiborne, South Claiborne, and the thing about Claiborne, Highway 90 is actually east and west. How do you figure out north and south in New Orleans for somebody that I kind of figured it out on my own, kind of like figured it out in talking to people, but if a person would come to New Orleans for the first time, how would they figure out which way is north and which way is south?
Yeah, that's the thing. They wouldn't, you know, because we don't talk about north and south here. If we're talking about north and south, we're talking about the Civil War, or as some people would say, the war between the states, or you might even hear the War of Northern Aggression at some point. But, you know, because of the way the city has the river cutting through it, it doesn't follow a grid pattern, or the French Quarter does. The French Quarter is an actual square or rectangle. But the rest of the city, because the river cuts through it, you know, like a sort of a serpentine pattern or crescent shape, we don't really go by north and south. So instead, we would say you would tell somebody, if you're given directions, you would say you would go toward the lake or you would go toward the river. Or you might even say what neighborhood they would go toward or what street they would go toward, you know, toward Canal Street or something along those lines. But, most often you'll hear toward the lake or toward the river instead of north or south. And, you know, it can be very, very perplexing. And that's, you know, that I think that's why we don't use the directionals. People, you know, like some people have pointed out, the West Bank is actually south of New Orleans. So it can be very confusing.
Yeah, that's one thing I learned, because, like, one thing I learned was, because I was like, West Bank, I'm like, you know, I was like, you know, when the first time I heard about the West Bank, I thought it was like, oh, it's west of the city.
Right.
And then, you know, yeah, that's why I thought, and then I have friends of mine, a guy named, you know, of course we know Keenan Lewis, he's from the West Bank. In fact,
yeah,
I basically was one of those people that wanted to see Keenan Lewis, the parish named Keenan Lewis Parish, named after Keenan Lewis. So that was one of the things that confused me. Now, reverting back to some of the things about the city, some urban legends I've heard over the years. One was the urban legend about Marie Laveau. And for the record, I think she's buried at St. Louis 1. Where is St. Louis 1, cemetery number 1, located at?
Yeah, I think it's number 1. I think it's right along Claiborne Avenue, kind of I guess it's on the edge of the French Quarter. If you cross Claiborne, you would be in Treme. And it's one of the older cemeteries, perhaps the oldest cemetery in the city. And it may be, I'm not sure about this, but it's either number 1 or number 2, where, if you've seen the movie Easy Rider, where Dennis Hopper and Peter Fonda are tripping on acid with a couple of girls that they picked up. But it's one of the oldest cemeteries in the city. It actually was just, they just changed the archdiocese, which controls it, the Archdiocese of New Orleans, the Roman Catholic Archdiocese, just changed their policy. You now have to pay to get into the cemetery. It used to be that anybody could go in and look around. It's a cool cemetery. You know, cemeteries are part of our unusual culture here, or unique culture, I should say. And, yeah, but I believe that's where she's buried, but there's also some dispute about whether, about which grave is hers, which tomb is hers. And there's even some dispute about whether Marie Laveau was really Marie Laveau, because she had a daughter or a child who people thought was her daughter, who became known as Marie Laveau after the first Marie Laveau died. So there's a lot of confusion and there's a lot of mythology surrounding Marie Laveau. But she was an actual person, of course.
Yeah, I
wrote a story about her last year, I think. Yeah, you know, she was a real person who had been a voodoo practitioner. There were occasionally stories about her in the newspapers of the 19th century. One when she was involved in a dispute over the ownership of a voodoo doll, which she tried to get back. I think she took a guy to court to try to get it back. You know, there were other sorts of stories like that. There was a story about how police were called to her house because of a wild voodoo event. And some of it smacks of discrimination. You know, you always have to read the newspapers of the 19th century and even the 20th century with, you know, keeping in mind the fact that there was a racial divide in the city that was even more severe than there is now. But, yeah, and then very late in her life, there was a reporter for the Daily Picayune who went to her house on St. Ann Street and interviewed her. And I found that story, I think it was late last year, and wrote about that interview. And it's just an extraordinary interview. You know, I think people tend to think of Marie Laveau as this mythological or mythical character, you know, and there are a lot of all kinds of tall tales about her. But this was an actual reporter who went down to her house and sat down with her and talked to her about her religion and talked to her about, you know, all kinds of fascinating stuff.
And from what I've seen, she was a very beautiful woman. From where the photos I've seen of her, she was a very beautiful woman.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
And and of course, we were talking basically on our show. Basically, we were talking because we were talking about this on Twitter. Me and some people, I say, dude, I'm pretty sure because I know some girls who have the same complexion as her, who have the same complexion of her, that I'm pretty sure if Marie Laveau was alive today and she existed in our time today, you know, we'd probably be beating our doors down for her. And the fact is, there was a girl who lived in the East named Erin, who is light-skinned, who I would not mind jumping into the Mississippi River for, even though I cannot swim worth a damn. but I know you talked about racial divide, and of course, the thing about Mardi Gras is one of the things that comes up because, you know, everybody on New Orleans Twitter, I was watching it on the internet, the Rex Comus thing.
Yeah.
Do you think Comus, despite the fact that I know the story that they were trying to do the stuff, before I go into it, Memphis had something almost similar to Mardi Gras. It was called the Cotton Carnival, and for some reason there were two different types. The white people had the Cotton Carnival. The black people had the Cotton Makers Jubilee. And for some reason, it literally was going to take over. It literally had a rival. It was going to rival Mardi Gras in New Orleans. And basically, when Dr. King got killed, downtown went to crap. Downtown went to shit. And basically, the carnival just, it phased out. It phased out because when you think of carnival in May here in Memphis, you mainly think of Memphis in May, which is a very good, a fantastic event. But when you think of, but before Memphis in May came into play, it was carnival. And the thing was, and the thing you talked about, the thing with New Orleans, it's like despite the fact of you know, despite the battles over the racial stuff, and I don't know how it is now. I was down there for the first weekend of carnival. Do you think that Comus will ever march in Mardi Gras?
Do I think they ever will again? I don't know. I mean, I don't have any intimate knowledge of that organization, so I really can't say. I do, you know, I think it's just hard to say. I think if you had asked people 50 years ago if there would ever be black people at the Rex Ball, they would have probably told you no way, you know. So it's, you know, it's not something I can say with any confidence one way or the other. But, you know, I do think that organizations and can change, you know, and people can change. I don't know that they will. But, you know, if you look at the NBA, it used to be an entirely white league of basketball players, you know, the NFL, same way. And they've changed, you know. I think that an organization could change. I think they could parade again. I don't know if they will. I don't know if they want to. They may find that that they're just happy the way things are now. I'm just not sure.
Right. Last year, I know you. I think last year or earlier this year, you did a story, and I've read it. It was on Louis Armstrong and his upbringing in New Orleans. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Right. Well, I thought it was a great story. It was fascinating for me to research it and to write it. But basically, I had a guy who follows me on Twitter reach out to me and send me a message, and he said, "Hey, I have some documents pertaining to the what was known as the Colored Waifs Home, which was sort of sort of half juvenile detention center, half school. I guess there's a third half like orphanage, because they took in children who just didn't have any parents either. And it used to be very, well, it still is, it's very well known that Louis Armstrong got sent to the Colored Waifs Home after he was arrested either on New Year's Eve 1912 or on New Year's Day 1913, when he shot off a pistol into the air. He got arrested. They sent him to the Colored Waifs Home. He spent about a year and a half there, and he learned to play music there. He was given a horn there. He began playing in the Colored Waifs Home band, which would perform in parades and picnics and stuff like that around the city. All that was very well known, but I got a message from this guy who told me he had documents from this home, and would I like to see them? And I said, of course, absolutely. So I met with him. His name is Alan Kimball, and it turns out he is married, or rather was married, to a woman who was the granddaughter of the couple that ran the Colored Waifs Home. And Alan had, back in the late 70s or early 80s, I don't have my story before me, so I'm not sure which, but he had gathered some documents from the family and preserved them and taken them around the world with him, basically. But they were documents from the Colored Waifs Home, and they show when kids were sent there. They show how many people were there. It's like a daily log sort of thing. And so he and I met, and we met, and I looked at his documents, and soon I saw in 1910 it had Louis Armstrong going to the home, and this was not something that anybody knew about. And so, you know, it was already going to be an amazing story, but I thought, well, I have this date in 1910 when Louis Armstrong was sent to this home. So I went back into the microfilm and looked at newspaper stories on that date, and I found a newspaper story about his arrest in 1910 for being a, quote, dangerous and suspicious character, which is kind of ludicrous because he was 9 years old at the time. How dangerous and suspicious could he be? But anyway, I found this news story about him being arrested when he was a kid. I had these documents showing when he was sent to the home, on what charge. My friend Alan Kimball, he has pictures from the home, negatives from the home. I was looking through other old microfilm, and I found another story about Louis Armstrong and the Waifs Home Band when he was, I think he was like 13 years old. And this was a newspaper story that nobody knew existed, or at least they didn't know it existed since 1913 or 1914, whenever it was from. And it describes him as the leader of the band, parading on, I forget what the holiday was called then, but it's Memorial Day now. And so it was just sort of an extraordinary find. It tells the names of everybody else who's in the band, describes the crowd cheering for them. You know, he apparently was a great showman already at 12 years old. I made for a pretty good story.
Well, to be fair, and I don't know really the gist. I mean, I know Louis Armstrong is probably the what is beloved in the city of New Orleans. But in his, you know, to me, I want to know, what was his, like, relationship with the city of New Orleans, you know, later in life? I mean, what was his feelings about the city of New Orleans, you know, about his hometown?
Right. Well, you know, as some people have noted, it's perhaps telling that he chose to live in Harlem was it Harlem or Queens maybe? He lived in New York City and not New Orleans. And, you know, he did visit here occasionally over the years and would usually drop in on Captain Joseph Jones and Manuela Jones, who ran the Colored Waifs Home. They were sort of like parental figures to him. But, you know, he was sometimes criticized for not being more outspoken about civil rights. But he did challenge it. You know, I believe he refused to play in Jefferson Parish for a time because they wouldn't allow an integrated band to play there. This was at a time when he had an integrated band. I don't have the story before me, but there was an incident where he criticized the president over some sort of institutionalized racism in Arkansas. I think he had an obvious affection for New Orleans and for the people of New Orleans, but I think, like many people, that the racism, the institutional racism of New Orleans bothered him, and I think he was clearly a victim of it. As a young man, he grew up on the streets basically as a kid, and had a very difficult life. He wrote about it in his autobiography about how he and his friends would salvage food from dumpsters and sell it to restaurants. They would sell coal. When he was a kid, when he was a very, very young kid, you know, when he should have been in school. He grew up at a difficult time here.
Now, the Storyville section of New Orleans, is that like, let me think, is that like where Handsome Willie's is, like Robertson Street, Cleveland, Tulane area, like not far from Charity Hospital? Where would the Storyville section of New Orleans?
No, that's more around what I think was referred to as Black Storyville. Of course, like everything else at the time, the red light district of New Orleans was segregated, where they had a separate one. But Storyville was on the other side of Canal Street, where the, what is the project? It's not a housing project called.
Iberville. Iberville.
It was kind of in that area. Esplanade. Yeah, there's actually one or two buildings, I think, at least as of a year ago, there were one or two buildings left that existed there during Storyville. I don't know that they operated as brothels at that time. In fact, I think they probably didn't, but they're buildings that were there in that era. Maybe they sold food or drinks or something like that.
Right.
But
go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
I'll go ahead and say it. All right.
I was going to say Storyville was shut down in 1917 because it had operated for over 20 years, I think, around 20 years, and it was, it was sort of a hotbed of criminal activity, alcohol, things that the righteous people despised. I believe the Secretary of the Navy had some role in having it shut down out of concern that it would affect the war effort.
Think about that. Sort of like the North Ordinance, you know, now almost. Is the Colored Waifs Home, is that like in Lakeview, like Canal Boulevard?
It's toward Lakeview. I don't know if it's considered Lakeview yet, but yeah, it's off of Canal Boulevard. If you know where the Bulldog is in Mid-City, it's kind of between there, kind of behind there. And there's railroad tracks that run through there. I think it's in his autobiography that Louis Armstrong writes about going to the railroad tracks and scrounging for wood that they would use to burn in their fires at the home. It's back in there. There's actually an old pauper cemetery back there too. I think it's called Holt Cemetery, which is where Buddy Bolden is buried, and where Peter Davis is buried. Peter Davis was the band instructor at the Colored Waifs Home. But there, you know, if you go back there, there's nothing to indicate that this is where Louis Armstrong learned to play the horn. There's nothing.
Is the building still there?
No, I believe it was demolished in the 50s or 60s.
Right, I know there's like so many like cemeteries. Like the first time I went up to Mid City, the first time I went deep into Mid City, you know, I saw Greenwood Cemetery, Greenwood Hope, and I actually pointed out to you that. Greenwood Cemetery is like not far from where the very first football game in New Orleans was ever played at.
Yeah,
I think I explained it to you. Yeah, it was right by Greenwood Cemetery, because Greenwood Cemetery is up there at City Park, and I think the stadium. I think it was. Right where the expressway is, because you
right.
have the expressway and then you have a cemetery.
I think they lost the ball in the canal or something, didn't they? There were some news
yeah,
stories
something
about
like
it
that.
At the time.
The very first football game, I think they lost the ball into the canal, which isn't far away. They lost that, and I know for a fact that the stadium was, I think it's like right at City Park. And I mean, I don't think there's anything there that marks it. I do know about Pelican Stadium. I've written about Pelican Stadium. I'm planning to write about Tulane Stadium for about.com. I mean, it's different when you're writing about travel as opposed to writing about sports. Sports, you know, you kind of like do your research and everything. But doing when you're writing something like for about.com, you have to like educate people on stuff. And so that's what I'm doing now. One last thing. Where were you when you learned that Jimmy Graham got traded?
I'm not sure. I think I was at work. I might have been. I don't honestly remember. I was shocked, I can tell you that, and I think maybe that's why I don't remember. Maybe some my mind is blocking
right.
it out or something. But it was a shocking trade. I don't think anybody saw it coming. You know, he's one of the most beloved players here. My kids talk about him all the time. You know, he had an off year last year, and. You know, they're making some tough moves. I don't know. I'm not a football coach. I don't want to say they messed it up, because you never know. You know, they must see something they like in the draft, and they had salary cap problems that they couldn't put off any longer, and made some tough decisions.
I mean, it happens with any football team. I get razzed a lot. Because I grew up a Colts fan. So I was on the other side when Super Bowl 44 happened. And then it's like now I go from Colts fan to being a Saints fan, and I don't hear the end of it. I will never hear the end of it. Because I grew up with, you know, it's kind of weird. Like now I'm a Saints fan, but 5 years ago I was on the other side, and it's kind of awkward. But then I think, and I told you this before, it's like with the Colts, it was never really. I don't think people really loved the Colts. They loved Peyton Manning. They love Andrew Luck. They don't really love the Colts. It's not really embedded. It's like now, the biggest thing in Indiana now is the basketball. You know, which team is going to go far in the NCAA tournament? They're not talking about football like they are in New Orleans. So it's like, it's like, this is like a, you know, this was shocking to me, you know.
I grew up in Indiana, in northern Indiana. And when I was a kid, I didn't know any Colts fans. We had people who were Bears fans or Notre Dame fans or Indiana University fans. I didn't know a single Colts fan. In fact, I don't think I knew a single Colts fan until Peyton Manning got there. So, you know, maybe things changed. Mm-hmm. I've been away from there for a long time. But, yeah, I didn't know a single Colts fan there. That's not to say there aren't any. You know, I'm sure there are some diehard Colts fans.
But it's not, like, it's not embedded in the culture. It's not embedded in the culture like it is in New Orleans. It's not. It's nothing like what you see in New Orleans.
People are rabid here. I will say, though, that as a fan, for me, free agency makes it really difficult. I understand why it's good for the players, and I think the players do deserve their money. But, you know, it's painful when we get rid of somebody like Jimmy Graham or when we get rid of, you know, Pierre Thomas. That dude was so big for us. You know, it's painful.
Yeah. But anyway, James, we thank coming to the end of our show, on the end of our podcast. Make sure you check out, just check it out on iTunes. Go to search Jerks with Radio. You can follow him, James Cartz, on Twitter at James Cartz. Real name, no gimmick. You can follow me at Twitter on Twitter at rhancock19. 6:30 Friday night, the Poetry Street Football and Social Club will be back on. We don't have – nobody's been traded this week, so we're probably going to have a very quiet show this week. So, that being said, we'll see you down the road.